First of all, I want to say I'm just so grateful to be here. Yes, there will be things that we will talk about, things I will share, but that doesn't happen if you all don't provide this space. And so I think it is a testimony to the fact that the Spirit of God is a maker of things. The Spirit of God is doing things all the time, creating things, just like it was doing on the second sentence of the Bible, right? That the Spirit is a hovering presence in the middle of chaos, right? The chaos waters of the first page of the Bible. And the Spirit presents itself, and it hovers, and then it speaks. And when it speaks, order and purpose emerge. And so I'm really, really grateful for what the Spirit is doing, even now. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. I do want to make just one comment. I drove up this first time in Kennett Square. I lived in Conshohocken for 4 years back when I was in residency training, but this is the first time I've been to Kennett Square. I've heard about Kennett Square, so it's great to be here. I'm thankful for that. I'm just noting that apparently people are far more interested in chocolate than they are in my books. Scott. For all the gifts. I mean, my birthday is on this 12th of September. I would, yeah, chocolate would be on, like, I don't, randomly, I could, yeah, anyway. Thank you. Let me also say that we're gonna talk about there's been a lot of information. And if you've read any of the things that I've written or listen to podcasts or speaking engagements or so forth. I want to assure us that there's information perhaps that we're going to talk about that you're familiar with, that you've heard. For some it might be new, but for others it may feel familiar. But you know, when you read the end of the fourth chapter of 2 Corinthians, there is that space where Paul talks about the weight of glory that is we are becoming. But just before this, he says, day by day, we are becoming newer day by day, which is kind of weird, don't you think? Like, you buy a new car, and you roll it off the lot, and it's old, right? 30 seconds later, the car is no longer new. But what the scriptures are telling us, that the story of the Bible says that tomorrow you will be newer than you are today. Are you with me? This is odd for humans. It's hard for us to get our heads around. But I want to assure us that every opportunity that we have to be in the presence of God, He is making us more and more real, more and more solid. And so even when we think that we've heard something before, I want to assure us that in the presence of the Spirit, God is going to take everything, even that we've heard before, and transform us into something newer now than we were 10 minutes ago. So the most important question that we need to be contending with in the time that we are together today is not just what is the information that we're hearing, how do I suddenly and somehow take all this in and so that I can appropriate it on Monday with my patients. The most important question is, what is the Spirit of God doing in the room right now? Who are we, not just who am I, but who are we becoming? Because I can assure you that each of us as individuals in this room only ever become who we are as individuals because of the people who are sitting next to us. Because this is the way that we've been made neurobiologically. This is the way that we've been made as God's image bearers. And so it's not just a matter of who am I becoming, but who are we helping me to become? Who are we helping you to become? Because we're all included in that project. Let me also say this. We do not, I'm a guy who believes we do not live in a neutral universe. That we live in a universe in which evil does not want this conversation to happen. Evil does not want us to imagine that tomorrow we will be newer than we are today. And so we all come here today from different places. And by different places, I don't just mean geographically. I mean, we come here today with all kinds of other competing things banging around in our heads. And in the course of our day, there will be things perhaps that will be that will emerge for us. Things that you're not just going to hear about information, you're going to be formed in such a way, and evil is competing with that formational process. And so, I'm a guy who, even as a psychiatrist, I believe in a thing called unclean spirits. I believe in the unseen, where I believe that there are the presence of things in the room that do not want what's happening in the room to happen. And so I just want us to be attuned to that. You know, as the Bible teaches us, we don't have to be, as far as evil is concerned, our job is not to be afraid, our job is to be vigilant. Our job is to be attuned, so that we can then decide how we are going to respond when evil shows up. And I will guarantee you, it is already showing up for us, because some of us are already here and you're worried about all the things you didn't get done or you're not going to get done. Anybody here with that? Right? You're like, what? Like, you're going to get home like, You know what I mean? Yeah. I know, because I do the same thing. I'm a professional sinner. I am not a rookie. I am not an amateur. I am good at it. So bear all of this in mind. So housekeeping item. So we have a slide deck for our morning time, and we have a slide deck for the afternoon. There are a lot of slides. In fact, there are more slides. I mean, there will be some that we're just going to blow through. I'm not even going to include them because as I include them. But I think, can we do that? All right. Because if you've signed up, you use your email address, and we'll send you the slide decks. Okay, so you can take notes if you want to, and if that's a helpful thing for you, cool, do that. And at the same time, I want to invite you, and you know, some folks now, you get your cameras out, you get your phone out, you take pictures of slides, so that you don't, and you can do that, but I'd rather you just be here, because the slides will come to you, and that way you can save storage space on your phone. You don't have to take those pictures. There we go. There's that. And, right. So, the morning conversation is going to be about shame, and the afternoon conversation is going to be about suffering. What a great day. I'm so happy to be here. And I want to begin by saying this about these two topics. We are a group of human beings who are primed to pay attention to the world as a problem to solve. Our brains are primed to do this. It takes no effort for you at all, for me at all, to be thinking about the problems that I'm facing. My anxiety matrix in my brain and in my body is continually having me look around the landscape. I am looking for danger all the time. And, you know, one might say from an evolutionary standpoint, we're doing this because we're looking for where the big cat is on the savannah who's about to devour us. All that may be true, but mostly we want to say it takes no effort for me to pay attention to the world as a problem to solve. Those of us who are therapists, people don't come to you in order to tell you about how wonderful their lives are. We don't do this. Are you with me? It takes no effort at all. It takes all kinds of effort for us to, with intention, pay attention to beauty and goodness in the world. The leading edge of the gospel, I might add, the leading edge of the gospel is not that we are sinners. The leading edge of the gospel is that we are loved. And if love walks into the room, I suddenly realize that I'm a sinner. Because when love walks into the room, look at all of our pop music. We want love to be in the room until it shows up. Because once it shows up, it wants to know things about me. It doesn't just show up to do for me what I want it to do. It shows up and asks for the parts about me that I hate the most. It wants to love those parts, but I don't really want to show Jesus those parts. I'm too busy working hard to keep them at bay. Are you with me? And then love starts making demands. We thought, I didn't know that love demanded anything of me. I thought, when I make my pop music, I dictate what love is supposed to do for me. The whole notion that love would come in and say, I want you to be a person of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithful, gentle, self-control. Like, that's not on my agenda for what love would require of me. It's not in my agenda to imagine that love would require of me to live the Sermon on the Mount. It would not require of me to be a person of justice. And suddenly, I realize I can't do that stuff. And so when love shows up, it doesn't have to tell me that I'm a sinner. I already know it. Are you with me? It takes very little for me to know if there's a problem. It is Herculean for me to turn my attention to beauty and goodness. But this is exactly what Jesus is saying. When he comes, he's looking for where the doctor is needed, not to name it as a problem that needs to be diagnosed and treated, but to see where beauty is waiting to be emerging. And as clinicians, one of the things that we're doing in our practice in the last several years, when we tell patients, they come in, they come in and they say, you ask, well, how can I be helpful? And they start to list all the ways in which their lives are troubled. Right? Because otherwise you wouldn't have a job. So we like trouble. But then we very quickly say to them, it's important for you to know. For all kinds of other people who have interest in such things, we're going to make a diagnosis. We're going to give you a code so that I can get paid and that you can get reimbursed. We're going to do that. But primarily, our work here is for us to create beauty and goodness out of your life. This is what God is up to. God is up to creating beauty and goodness. This is very difficult for us to pay attention to. And the reason is because we are so loaded with shame and with our suffering. And so the reason that we're going to pay attention to these things is not because they are the most important thing, but because they get in so much of the way of the most important things that we do as clinicians, that we do as pastors, that we do as parents, that we do as husbands and wives, that we do as children of adult parents who are still driving us crazy. Okay. So beginning with this, it's important for us to recognize that you think, like, well, we're going to kind of learn all about shame and learn all about suffering and so forth. But the most important, one of the more important questions we ask is, in what story do you believe you're living? This is the most important question that we're going to ask patients. They're going to come in with their depression, their anxiety, and their this and their that, their eating disorders, and all the things. And we think that the most important question is, like, what's the symptom protocol? We're going to check the boxes and see. I want to tell you, the most important question begins with, in what story do they believe? In what story do I believe I am living? I will tell you. We who are in this room might say that we believe that we're living within the context of the biblical narrative, except when I leave my house. Because when I leave my house, or when I come home from my day, and I'm irritable with my wife, it's in that moment that I can tell you, I don't believe the gospel. I don't believe I'm living in that place. I don't believe I'm living in a world of generosity. I think I'm living in a world of scarcity. In that world. Because of my own unfinished business. And so it's crucial for us to recognize that the story in which we believe we are living is shaping so much of all the downstream stuff that's happening that we're going to talk about, that if we're not talking about that story and continue to come back to that story and be curious about what that story is, none of this will matter. This morning, in what story do we believe we're living? And who's telling it? This is the other thing. Stories don't just emerge in the world all by themselves. Somebody has to tell them. Michael Polanyi, the well-known, now deceased, but well-known philosopher of science, once said, there's no such thing as science. There are only scientists. Science, and you hear this all the time. Well, we know from science. No, we don't know. There is no such thing as science. This is like, have you ever met it? Has it talked to you? What's it look like? Is it blonde? No. We only hear from human beings. And this is crucially important because in the question of, like, in what story do I believe I'm living, is always the question behind that, which, who are the people that are telling you the story about yourselves that you think is true? Who are the people involved? They might not even be alive, let alone not even be in the room. Even for us now in the room, for us who come here with all kinds of things in our minds and our hearts, There are things that are in our head, but we wonder, like, who are the people that are telling you those things? Is it our parents? Is it our good friends? By whom are we so deeply known such that those people who are providing the voices that are telling me something, who's telling me the story about any of this? This is a crucial question for us to answer. And then this thing I want to say about the news about shame is far worse than we know, which is really encouraging, right? And yet it's also far better than we can imagine. And this is what the gospel is all about. The gospel comes and says, look, we have very little idea about how bad things actually are. And part of the reason that we don't know these things is because we're so well accommodated by our culture, right? We have all kinds of things living in the moment that we live in the West. We're well-heeled, we're well-fed, we don't have lots of physical troubles to bother us. We have all kinds of accessories in my life that can keep me from my life. In fact, I tell people routinely when we talk, when we work with patients, you know, because you come in and say, like, well, this person has a really complicated life. This situation is really complex. I say, look, life is very simple, and it is excruciatingly difficult. But it is not difficult because it's complicated. It is difficult because we are sitting in a small boat on an ocean of fear that sits itself on top of an ocean of shame. And the boat that we live in is the narrative that we have constructed over the course of our life to cope with and to keep us from being in that water, that chaos water that we read about on the very first page of the Bible. Are you with me? Now, things feel complex, and we create that complexity and that complicated life largely by listening to and telling voices, and listening to and talking to voices who are going to tell me things about my life that are going to only reinforce my fear and my shame. And along into this space, Jesus comes walking on the chaos waters, just like he did with Peter, and he says, I want you to get out of the boat. I want you to consider leaving the story that you've been telling yourself that is part and parcel of how it is that you are symptomatic in the way that you are in the first place. And I won't do it. It's hard for me to do this. And so we have to recognize that our darkness, our evil, is powerful mostly because of its subtlety, mostly because of its mystery, not because it's complicated, but it's because it's so difficult for us to imagine touching the third rail of our shame. And that's why we're going to talk about it. Okay, if we're going to talk about shame at all, it's important for us to have a run-up to how is it, before we even get to what shame is or how it operates, it's important for us beforehand to have a sense of, once shame is in the room, what is it doing? And how is it creating challenges for us? The first thing to say is that shame, by the way, in and of itself is not bad. Shame in and of itself is necessary for us to grow into mature human beings. In fact, there are any number of human behaviors for which shame is the appropriate response when we commit them. Perhaps some of our challenges culturally is that there's not enough of shame where it needs to be. And so it's important to know it's built into the created order. The first couple sensed something, felt something. It was already built into the machinery, into the mechanics of how we operate. The moment that they decided that they were going to turn themselves away from God's way of deciding what's right and wrong in the world. Are you with me? So we first want to say, shame in and of itself is not the problem. It is how we respond to it that is problematic. And in order for us to have a better sense of what we're doing when we respond to it, it's helpful for us to understand how are we ideally made mechanically to operate in the world. So we're going to talk about some mechanics. You know, we talk about, look, science tells us about the mechanics of how things work. That's what it does. It tells us, it describes the mechanics of how things work. For instance, if you're an alien, I love this when Leslie Newbegin wrote this. He said, well, if an alien were coming to Earth and happened upon a locomotive, an alien, without knowing what it was, an alien could probably, if they're really smart, they could pick apart the locomotive. They might even see train tracks, and they could see how it is supposed to do what it does. But the alien would have no idea about the mind of the person who created it in the first place for its purpose. Like, what is its purpose? Like an alien, if they're big enough, they could just pick it up and maybe use to drive stakes in the ground. I don't know. Right? You with me? So science tells us about mechanics, and knowing mechanics is really important for the following reason. If you go to, anybody here go to a physical therapist? Is everybody here who is a physical therapist? Oh, you are, right. PT, right? Like pain and torture, right? Has anybody ever said that to you before? Oh my, speaking of shame, right? I mean, it's just, right. So, what's your name? Vicky, and you admitted that. You're telling me, so identifying it. So like, Vicky the physical therapist. Right, so you can tell me if this is, we've seen studies that look at this. Like if you're a physical therapist and you just give people the exercises to do that you're gonna go home and do. If you get the mannequin out, if you get the skeleton out, and you point out to people the mechanics of how, when you do this, this is going to happen, people are far more likely to go home and do it. Not your patients. But we tend to be more likely to do things that we are able to understand the mechanics of. This is why our left brain is so important. I need to have a sense of how things work, because in knowing how things work, I am more likely to implement it. Because otherwise, you're just giving me some exercise to do without me having a sense of agency regarding how what I'm doing is leading to proximal change, leading to the changes that I want. Does that make sense? And so we're going to talk about the mechanics, not because it's magical, not because science is magic. It doesn't tell us all the reasons why we do what we do, but it helps us understand what's going on when shame walks in the room. Okay. If we're going to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength, it might be nice to know what the mind might be. Would it be fair to say? Now, most of us, when I went to medical school and to residency, I did not have a single course, I did not have a single class on what the mind actually is, which is kind of strange. The psychiatrist, no courses on what the mind is. And yet, they let me charge people money to, you know, do things with their minds. You would guess that an orthopedic surgeon would know what a bone is, what an osteocyte is, how it works. Now, here's the thing. We're well acquainted, especially therapists who are in the room, we're well acquainted with what happens when the mind is not working well. We know all, like, you, anybody here take a course called Abnormal Psychology? Right, so you have entire course, you have entire books on abnormal. One would like to think that there would be a course on normal psychology. And there would be like a library's worth. Instead of like these big books on what it looks like for the humans who are not doing well. But we would like to know, what does a mind actually look like? And what does it look like if it's flourishing to begin with? Again, we're not even talking about the Bible yet. We're just talking about how we observe the mechanics of how the mind works. And so, because if we want to love God with all of our mind, such that it can be transformed, therefore don't be conformed to this world. Right? This is Romans chapter 12. Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And notice that Paul says, I beseech you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your body, present your entire body, not just my physical body, but this body, the entire body. Paul does this strange thing with pronouns, your body, presenting everything, my physicality and our community to God, such that we might be transformed, not going to be squeezed into the mold of the world that is forming us. Well, if I'm going to do that, what is, so that my mind might be transformed, what is my mind such that it can be transformed in the first place? So we're going to talk about that first, a working description of the mind, in order for us to have a better sense of what it looks like when shame walks in the door. So in our work in interpersonal neurobiology, we like to talk about the mind being an embodied and relational process, that emerges from within and between brains whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. You got that? So here, we're going to walk through this, but here's the thing. Every single part of this is important. Because the mind is not, as it turns out, it's not just the thing with which I think. It's not just the thing with which I feel. It's multiple things. And the first thing that it is it's an embodied thing. It's embodied. Your mind is embodied. How do you know that you're anxious anytime you are? How do you know you're anxious? Like, if we cut you off from your access to your body, you couldn't know that you're anxious. You might have a thought, but it is your body that is giving you all of that other sensation that gives you the sense of what anxiety actually is. Right? But not just anxiety. Joy, relief, all those things that we feel with our bodies. You're watching a stand-up comedian. Like, your body is 90% of the show. Because of all of the vulnerability, all of the release that you feel when you are laughing as you are with other people in the room. You with me? So the body is an integral part of the mind, right? This is where we begin. And this is a reflection of what we read about on the second page of the Bible. The Lord God formed the man from the mud of the earth. Right? This is Genesis 2:7. We start with mud. When you take the mud and you take the spirit, and then God breathed the breath of life into man's nostrils, and man became a living being. So we are mud and we are breath, and if you take either one of those away, we stop being human. It's important because it highlights how significant our bodies are. It also highlights how it is that when our bodies are mistreated through trauma, things are happening to the rest of us. Are you with me? So the mind is an embodied and relational process. It's a relational process, meaning that my mind is, again, it's not just what I think, it's not just private to me. Because when a newborn comes into the world, we like to say, you've heard me say this, every newborn comes into the world looking for someone looking for her, looking for someone looking for him. Everyone does. But when they come in with their 100 billion neurons, only about 80 to 85% of those are, are going to still require the interaction with another human being in order for them to fire properly. Only about 15 to 20% of those neurons are ready to go and do their work on their own. We require that much interaction relationally for my mind to form and be active. And in this way, we recognize that as parents, we are so much of the engine behind what is happening with our children, right? Good luck. But you see what I mean, right? So we already see very quickly that my mind is not just my body. My mind is my body's relationship with other people's bodies and minds. So it is an embodied and relational process. It's ongoing. It's moving. It's not static, ever. We sometimes find ourselves feeling stuck. Have you ever felt stuck? We find ourselves feeling stuck, and we feel static. We'll get to how shame is playing a role in that. But one of the things that's important for us to recognize that when we have that sensation, we think like, I feel stuck, and what I want to suggest to you, that that's a measurement not so much about your stuckness as much as it is a measure of your disconnection relationally from someone else. That's what it's a measure of. Now, we perceive it as me being stuck, but it is primarily functionally a feature of my being disconnected from someone else. And so the body and relationship, that's an embodied relational process that emerges from within and between brains. I know that some of you have children here. I mean, they're not here. Thanks be to God. Right? Anybody here leave children all away? I mean, like, you came here, you left children someplace else? You can admit this. It's okay. You know, your children are someplace else, and you're kind of glad that they're there and you're here, and you're not having to take care of them. I have kids who are 33 and 31. A daughter who's 33, a son who's 31, and 30. And I still want to be in charge of their life. Amen? Yeah. As it should be. I want to be in charge of their life. And the whole notion that things emerge in the world without my being able to fully predict it is unsettling. Our children think that they can just decide whatever they want to do without their parents' permission. How dare they? Right? There is this sense in which they are agents in the world now and they're going to do things. Heck, some of us have already this morning, things have happened in the lives of some of us here that we didn't see coming. Some of us in the last week have received news that we didn't expect to get. Things emerge. And when they do, it affects who I am becoming because my mind and yours is an emergent process. And the beautiful thing about the Bible is that God has made us to be this way in order for us to be curious instead of condemning about what emerges from a landscape. So it is an embodied and relational process that emerges from within and between brains. Right? It's happening within me, but it's also happening between you and me at all times. It's happening even right now between you and the person that you're sitting next to, even if you don't know that person. And now that I've said that, now you're wondering about the person that you're sitting next to. Right? Imagine if we were having this conversation and there was only one of you here in the room, and you're sitting there and I'm up here. That would be weird, right? Because who has a conversation like that? Hey, let's go to the auditorium and you sit there and I'll sit on the people. We just have an intimate conversation about your life. No, that we wouldn't be doing this. But you see, things are happening in the room now, even if the way they are, primarily because there are other brains in the room. Are you with me? The question is, am I paying attention to this? It's an embodied relational process that emerges from within and between brains, whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. Notice I'm not saying that its task is to control it. Its task is to regulate it. And by energy, the first thing we mean by energy is we would say that all of the neurobiochemical stuff that is happening within me and that is happening within you and that is happening between us, all the photon waveform of the light energy that's happening, all of the sound energy that is happening, all of the things that are happening from all of our nonverbal cues that communicate 70 to 90% of everything humans say to each other, all that's happened in the room, all this energy. Are you with me? But with this energy, we are continually having to make sense of it, and that's the information. We are information people, and by information, we don't just mean informatics. We don't just mean points of data. We don't just mean we're collecting pieces of an abstract thing we call information. What we're talking about is that we as human beings are meaning makers. We are storytellers, which we'll get to in just a moment, but at all times, we are having all of this energy that's happening within me, within you, between us, and we are continually trying to make sense of what's happening in the room. And you can't not do it. You're trying to have a conversation with somebody, and you really want to be with them in that conversation, and you discover that your bladder is really full. And now you've got information coming from them, and you've got information coming from down below. Right? And you're trying to make sense of this moment. What do I do? Do I say, can I please pause so I can go to the bathroom? You know what I mean, right? Things as simple as this, this is what we're doing all the time. You're in a conversation with your spouse. You know how this goes. You're having a conversation that you think is going one direction, and suddenly, in the middle of a sentence, you make a right angle turn. There's no signal. And now you're in the middle of a different conversation and you're in trouble. This is an energy shift and you're trying to make sense of what just happened. Right? For all the dudes in the room. Right? You're thinking, I'm going to work really hard because I want to have, like, tomorrow with my wife, I'm going to have sex tonight. Any guys here? Okay, this would be like, you want to be vulnerable? Any guys here want to have sex with your wife tonight? They're like, no. We're just going to laugh. Nobody's raising their hand. Can we say that word? Sex? Can we say that word? Yeah. Right? Right. And how many times, you're working really hard with a dude. You're working really hard because you know that you'd like to have sex with your wife, and you're in the middle of the conversation at dinner time. You're like, this is going pretty well because so far I haven't screwed things up that badly. Like, this might happen. And then there at the dinner table, you say something and you see the look. and you don't know what you just said, but 30 seconds from now, like, you know you're not getting any tonight. You just know that. You know what I mean? Because we are continually trying to make meaning. We are trying to make sense of what we're sensing. And what we're doing is we're telling stories. This is what we're telling them in our head. We're telling them to each other. And all those stories are being filtered by all the stories that have been told to us and about us in the course of our lifetime. This is the normal practice of the mechanics of the mind. Are you with me? This is what we do. On the best of days, this is what we do. And one of the ways that we do this uses a feature of neuroplasticity. Many of us now we're familiar with this, right? The capacity of the brain to flexibly adapt and make changes. We could talk for an hour about neuroplastic change. When I was in med school 40 years ago, and somebody would be at the VA, somebody would have a stroke, they'd be in the hospital for 6 weeks, and we'd send them home and tell them good luck. Now, if you have a stroke, you're going to go to the rehab center where 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're going to work. And you're going to work for the next 10 weeks. Because of what we've learned about what brains can do flexibly and adaptively as far as neural changes. So we want to take advantage of this in the creation of new neural networks. This is what we're doing. This is what newborns are doing. The newborn does not know that this is her hand. The newborn has to somehow figure out that this is her hand. It passes in front of her, and what was that? Right? I can do things with this. You see what I mean? We're doing this all the time. So neuroplasticity is always involved. And another thing that's involved is this thing called emotion. This is really crucially important. I hear different things about this word. All kinds of things about this word. It is important that we recognize that this word is really important, and it is not the most important thing in the world. When we talk about emotion, what are we talking about? From an interpersonal neurobiological perspective, emotion is the energy around which the brain organizes itself. It's the energy we're talking about. There's nothing that we do, that is not emotionally related. Everything we're doing is a response to or a creation of emotional connection, emotional energy. It's always happening. We talk about it in terms of it being the fuel in the tank of the car. There's nothing that you do with an automobile that's not a function of fuel regulation. You turn the car on, you turn the car off. You speed it up, you slow it down. You make a turn, you go straight. All these things are about fuel regulation. But we don't build automobiles just for us to have a place to put gasoline. The gasoline is not the point, but the gasoline is absolutely necessary for everything that we do. And so we may have heard it said, well, we can't trust our emotion. It's like saying you can't trust the gasoline in your car. That would be odd to say that. I don't know how I can. I have to have it in order for my car to turn on, let alone for it to go someplace. Emotion is absolutely necessary. In fact, if you look at the center of the Bible, we have an entire Psalter, 150 of them, that are all about emotion. That are all about a way for us to process all of this energy. How do we then regulate this? And so it's going to be crucially important for us to recognize, when it comes to shame in particular, that emotion is a big part of the game. Not because it's the most important part, but because how we pay attention to it, how we direct our patients to pay attention to what are you feeling, is a crucially important question. In the work that we do in our confessional communities, which we'll get to later in the day, one of the questions that we are continually asking is, what are you feeling? What are you feeling? What are you feeling? And the reason we ask this is not because emotion is the most important thing, but it is primal to everything else that follows it. And if I'm not paying attention to it, I end up acting it out without having any sense of its being a source for what my actions are about. And so we ask this question over and over, followed very quickly by, and where do you sense it in your body? Right? Because we are mud, and we are breath. And that emotion is neuroplastically forming you, And it's going to form you in the way it's going to form you as a way to try to get your attention. And if you're not paying attention to it, it's going to form you in ways that you won't want to be formed. Are you? So asking the question, what are you feeling, and paying attention to that is a crucially important element of what we're doing when we're caring for patients. Okay. So we had a definition of what the mind is. Remember, we're getting to shame and what it tends to do. We're going to get there. We had a conversation about what the mind is. But what does a mind look like that flourishes? And the mind that flourishes, again, we're talking about mechanics. We're not even talking about purpose yet. We haven't gotten to anthropology. We haven't gotten to, you know, what does it mean? Teleology, the purpose, the intended purpose of a mind that flourishes. What does it look like when the mind flourishes? And we like, in our world, we like to use this word, interpersonal neurobiology, we like to use this word integration. And it has a particular use in our world. And integration is a matter of differentiation and linkage. Different parts that are well developed come together in concert and are linked together in order for them to make a creative whole. And one of the things that we, the metaphors we use, is that of an orchestral arrangement. If you can imagine that an orchestra has several sections, and each of those sections needs to practice its part really well. We're gonna perform Beethoven's Ninth. So we're also gonna add a choral section. And each of those sections is gonna practice really, really well. And we want them to practice well, but the other thing that they're gonna have to be able to do is to listen to the other sections. I can't just have the brass playing whatever they please. They're going to have to listen to others. How do we have them do this? How do we have them come together? And we would say, well, we need a conductor. We need someone to whom all the sections can listen to, who will kind of help them practice well, but also keep them connected to other parts of the orchestra. Now, for the human, the anatomical location for where my conductor lives is what we call the middle prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that sits right behind your forehead, right behind your eyes. And that's where all of this conduction eventually happens when we are doing the work that we do as individuals in the world, as adults, hopefully. But in order for my conductor to do well, it has to go to conductor school. It has to learn from some other conductor. And we'll get to this. This is what attachment is all about. Attachment, when we talk, we'll eventually talk about the 9 domains of integration. And in research, we know that 8 of those 9 domains of integration, when a person is well integrated, when differentiation and linkage is taking place in a healthy way, 8 of those 9 domains are highly correlated with the development of secure attachment. The development of secure attachment enables those first 8 that we'll get to, these first 8 domains of the mind's function to function well. And so when you imagine an orchestra playing well, you have all these different sections that are playing well on their own, but they're also coming together and listening to others. So imagine if you have grown up in a house where my parents were in their mid-40s when I was, some of you know this story. My parents were in their mid-40s when I was born. My brothers were 18, 16, and 11 years old when I was born. My 18-year-old brother went off to college, and I was born a week later. And he comes home at Thanksgiving. Like, what's this? What is this? And, my parents were not particularly like celebratory when they found out that they were pregnant with me. They thought they were done. And I came into a world in which, as it turns out, before I was anything else, I was the source of anxiety. Now, I didn't know that. I have a picture of my parents the night before I was born. You thought you were looking at a picture of a couple who just lost a child. It's right, because they're this upset, like, this is not where they want to be going. Are you with me? And we can talk long about epigenetics and so forth, about the, you know, generational trauma and all those kinds of things, but the point is that when it comes to the home in which we grow up, I again entered a home in which there was anxiety. But then, very quickly, as I learned from my mom, I grew up in an evangelical Quaker tradition. Okay, any of you have heard of an evangelical Quaker? Some of you right now are trying to get your mind around an evangelical Quaker at all. But I grew up in that tradition, with two God-fearing parents who loved Jesus and loved each other and loved their kids and so forth, and they were imperfect. And one of the ways that they were imperfect was it was not easy for them to know, they didn't know what to do with their anxiety. My mom didn't know what to do with her anxiety. And she had her own story of trauma. And my dad had his own story in which, in the house, Lewis Thompson was not a guy who had an anger problem. And primarily because everybody was working so hard not to piss him off. And so I grew up learning to be afraid of anger. And I learned to do everything I could to work out other people's anxiety where I was able to. Because those two things were not comfortable for me. Are you with me? So this is like a section of my orchestra that never gets any practice. The whole notion of naming what you're upset about, if it has to do with what's going on right now, even between you and your parents, is not a section of the orchestra for me that ever got any practice. Are you with me? And then imagine, I get married to a wonderful woman who, as it turns out, has no problem being angry. And I'm like, shit. You know what I mean? And so we've grown up in different homes in which different parts of our orchestra didn't get any training. Or we grew up in homes where maybe emotion was everywhere. I have a patient who, when I first met him, he was in his mid-40s, and this is a guy who hand over foot had just turned all kinds of things into gold. He bought and sold three, he had started and sold three companies. He was on his fourth by the time I met him. He was very anxious. And he's like, what do you have to be anxious about? Like, you're really curious. But this guy, he's very, very anxious. Now, he had some things going on currently in his life, but when you ask the question, as clinicians will do, tell me about what it was like growing up in your house, he said, I grew up in a loving Christian home. Which is code for life sucked, but you just couldn't say that. And so after he tells me he grows up in a loving Christian home, he said, well, who was in charge of discipline in your house? By the way, there's a lot of questions that therapists get to ask people that actually, they're great questions for cocktail parties. If you're, seriously, imagine, you're at the cocktail party, you run out of things to say, you say, hey, Joe, who's in charge of discipline in your house? Just ask, see where this goes, right? So you ask my patient, who's in charge of discipline in your house? And he says, well, as it turns out, it would be my mom, because anytime my dad, who was deacon in the church, anytime my dad got involved, things would quickly become brutal. Now you're wondering, how do we juxtapose? I grew up in a loving Christian home, and this is the story that he has told and that he believes. If you were to ask him anywhere, anytime, any day, he would tell you, this is the home in which I grew up. And but nobody's asking him the question, who was in charge of discipline in your house? Because he's worked really hard to make sure that brutality and violence and all the fear that contains is not within a country mile of his consciousness. Are you with me? And so there are things that are happening in his orchestra growing up. It's not just about a section that didn't get practice. It was a section that got run over by a 4x4 in the concert hall. And this is all part of, however, what it would look like for the orchestra to be well developed. And even now, we who are here may have parts of our own stories that are what we're being reminded of, where we either didn't have the chance to differentiate, we didn't have the chance to name things that we wanted to name, or if we did, we weren't able to link those with other things. If I had the feeling of anger, was I able to actually link that to language that taught me how to name this, taught me how to be angry and sin not? Did I have a connection with another human being who helped me navigate this? And if I don't, I can tell you that my life is going to be fraught. But you can see the mechanics of how it is intended to operate. we like to talk about the river of integration. This notion that on one side of life, we will often cope by being chaotic. We are aware of parts of us at times. Anybody here feel chaotic at times? Right, we have parts of us that just feel chaotic. And there are times when our life feels chaotic in general. And on the other extreme, the other bank of the river, we have this rigidity that we can employ. Right? I'm just going to work like my friend, my patient. Right? I have a loving Christian home. I'm going to be rigid. Like, I'm not going to let any of this other stuff into the room. Are you with me? And it's in between these two banks, one of chaos and one of rigidity. This is this river, this flow of energy and information, because we are doing the work together that we need to do in order for a mind to flourish. It resembles what we call this acronym FACES, and we can ask our patients this question: to what degree do we feel flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable? We might say, if we were to map the book of Galatians onto this, we might say, a person who has a life of, we're flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable, we say, oh, this is a person of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Are you with me? That's what FACES is. And so we can ask our patients this. Let's just explore. To what degree does your life, where do you see in your life if you are these things, these five things? And where in your life do you feel like you're nudging closer to one bank or the other of the river? Or another way to think, like, is there a part of your life, what you sense, what you image, what you feel, what you think, what you want to do with your body, that is not getting much practice, not getting much differentiation? And are there ways in which any one of those parts are not being very easily or effectively linked to the other part of the orchestra? These are ways for us to be curious about people's lives, because we're using the mechanics of how the mind actually operates. Because what we really see is, at the end of the day, we were created for joy. Now, I wrote a book that came out a couple years ago called The Soul of Desire, and we talk about this notion that we, before we were anything else, we are people of great longing. We are created as people of great joy. And the reason that we know this is because you just read the first page of the Bible. When you read the first page of the Bible, one of the first things that you see about God is that God is a creator. He's a maker. He's an artist. The Hebrew writers are brilliant in that they're like great movie producers. Like, they don't explain things, they just show you things. If you were to just read the first page of the Bible, and at the end of it, you say, like, tell me about God. Tell me about God. Don't just tell me, like, what he does, or, like, tell me about, and you're like, gosh, I would have to, like, imagine that. I'd have to think that, because the first page of the Bible does not say, God is this, God is that, God is this. It's just telling us what God's doing. Are you with me? But when God does the things that he does, he gets to the end of the first day, the second, and the third, the fourth, and he says, it's good. It's good. Are you with me? The Hebrew language for good, the English word good, can be interchanged with the Hebrew word for beautiful. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's not just beautiful because I made it. It's not just beautiful because it's sitting over there. Its beauty emerges as a function of me looking at it. I want to say this to you today. One of our biggest challenges as human beings is that we are unaware of the role that we have been designed to play in bringing forth the beauty of others on the earth. I want to assure you that others' beauty emerging is dependent upon them being seen by you. Are you with me? But most of us don't walk around thinking, gosh, I wonder who's going to have the privilege of being in the room with me today. You know what I mean? We're worried about our being in the room. Are you with me? This notion that we were created for joy, we were created for beauty, we were created for goodness. The 11th verse of the 86th Psalm: Lord, teach me your ways that I may know your truth. Create within me an undivided heart. An undivided heart. This notion, give me a heart that is differentiated and linked. Are you with me? But I can't do that if A, I don't know what the orchestral sections are in my mind, and if B, I don't have someone who's helping me put all of this together. So, you ready? If you've seen this for the first time, the slides will be there. But many of you have, you're familiar with this, but imagine that your orchestra has nine sections, not just four. Your orchestra has nine sections, and the first section we talk about is a section of consciousness. Okay, how awake, alert, and attuned are you, am I? To what degree am I paying attention to what I'm paying attention to? We like to talk about attention being the ignition key of the mind. The ignition key of the mind. And I need to have a sense of what that is in order for me to know where I'm going. Because everything that I do is a function of where I'm next turning my attention. And we look, there are biblical references that are related to this. So when we read, like Romans 8:5, the mind that is on the spirit is life, but the mind that is on the flesh is death. And by flesh, Paul's not talking about the body. He's talking about the way of the evil way of the world. What does it mean for us to pay attention to the vertical domain, right? This is our body. We as human beings have a vertical domain, not just because of my body, but because of how my body functions. I have a spinal cord that runs north to my brainstem, that runs to my right hemisphere, that crosses to the left hemisphere. The left hemisphere helps me make sense of what I sense. But if I'm not paying attention to what my brainstem and my limbic circuitry and my right hemisphere are sending to my left, my left hemisphere will be finding itself doing all kinds of things. It's trying to dampen, it's trying to cope with what my right brain is sending it. Am I able to pay attention to that? And then I get to what we call the horizontal domain. This notion that I have a right and a left brain, and the right hemisphere comes online for human beings before the left does. There is a sequence to this. And this is important, because the sequence never really ends. And this is what's important to this. You can look at the right and left hemispheres of the brain, and you'll notice that, you know, people say, well, I'm a left brain or I'm a right brain, but that stuff actually is not really true, right? That's not a real thing in the world. There's no such thing as a right brain person or a left brain person. What we know is that developmentally, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere are able to do pretty much what each other is able to do. They both have the capacity for doing lots of things that the other hemisphere does early in development. But what happens is that over time, with development of each human being, the right hemisphere takes up certain work and the left hemisphere takes up certain work. And so it's not as easy then for my right and my left to just exchange their jobs, but they can. But here is one way in which they are different. The most important way that the right and left hemisphere are different is how they attune to the world. The right hemisphere is a hemisphere that attunes to the world by being with it. I'm with you. I'm not analyzing you from a distance. I am with you. I am enjoying you. Your right hemisphere, when you're in a stand-up comedy show, when you're there, your right hemisphere is on fire. You're with the comedian. You're with this. You know what I mean. You're just with someone. You're not analyzing them. You're not looking at them from a distance. You're with. This is where empathy plays a significant role. I am with someone. But I also need my left hemisphere, because my left hemisphere sees the world from a distance. It sees the world from a distance, and we need to be able to see the world from a distance in order for us to be able to reflect and analyze the things that we are sensing. If all I did was sense, when I have a flat tire, I would just be awash in the feelings that I had about the fact that I have a flat tire. I wouldn't be able to fix it, which would be problematic. I want to be able to fix the flat tire so that I can go pick up my wife at the airport, which is what I really want to do, so I can be with her. And what we find sometimes is that because of our unfinished business, we can find that our right or our left is being overplayed or underplayed. That's another domain. And we move from there to this domain of memory. We could talk all day just about memory and the fact that there's nothing that we do in the world that is not ultimately something that we're remembering doing. And the real question then is, what am I encoding in my memory that becomes my anticipated future? Everything that we pay attention to, we remember, and what we remember becomes our anticipated future, which is why we talk about remembering, our future. Which is why we say there's no such thing as fear of the unknown. You ever hear somebody say, I'm afraid of the unknown. Are you with me? You get that. I want to say there's no such thing. Because if I'm afraid of something, the thing I'm afraid of, even if it's not real in the material world, is something that I'm constructing in my own mind out of my experience that I've had in the past. And so which is really important, because when someone says, I'm afraid of the unknown, you can say, actually, that's not possible. So let's explore what it is that you are anticipating that you're afraid of. So there is the memory, and then there is this thing called the narrative domain, which we'll get to in a little more detail, which is all about attack, how we tell our stories. And then we get to this state domain, right? The fact that we have different states that we occupy throughout the course of our day, throughout the course of even moments within our day. Am I paying attention to my transition from state to state to state to state? Because so much of what creates trouble for us, so much of where shame will occupy things for us, is in the transition from one state to another where we don't see it coming. The interpersonal domain. We talked earlier about the fact that our brains are not just singular, siloed things, that they are having interactions with other people. We're having them right now. Who are the people that are in our lives who are helping us tell the story about who we believe we are? And then we talk about this notion of a temporal domain. This is... It's important, you know, we like to say that one of the questions that we have that I ask patients, you're depressed, you're anxious, you've got a drinking problem, you don't expect to have a psychiatrist introduce the word eschatology into your conversation. But at some point we're going to say, I'd like to have a conversation today about eschatology. They're like, what are you talking about? What is eschatology? Eschatology is our sense of the way the world's going to end. Are you with me? It's like, what is the big picture? Where is this all going? And here's the thing. Everybody has one. Everybody has an eschatology. Everybody has a story that has an end that they believe is coming. And by believe that they're coming, I don't mean that they can tell you theologically where it's coming. I mean that their life is demonstrating, this is the story, and this is how my life, being lived as it is telling how my life is going to end. But we anticipate an eschatological change in the future, a consummation of some kind, and that is circling back around temporally to affect my present moment. And I have to sort that out with people because they're unaware at all that they have an eschatological future that is shaping who they are right now. But somebody else is always going to be involved in telling the story that is my eschatology. Who are the people? Who are the voices? We're getting back to this, right? You'll see that all these things are talking to each other, all these different sections. The question is whether or not they're well-developed and whether or not they're talking to each other, and do I have people in my life who are enabling me to do that? Then we led to this last one, this transpirational. It's a made-up word by my friend Dan Siegel. He made this word up. And what Dan is saying is this, saying like, look, if we are willing to pause long enough and reflect on all of these different sections of the orchestra, we find that the more that we pay attention to them, you can't pay attention to all of them simultaneously. You move from one to another, to the next, back and forth through rhythm. The more we pay attention to rhythm in this way, the more we become attuned to all the different ways in which they're interacting with each other, the more each of these sections gets their proper attention, they can become differentiated, the way they can be linked to others, and Beethoven's Ninth is played really beautifully. Are you with me? The way that we do this, primarily, is through storytelling. This is how human beings, this is how we navigate our lives. It doesn't matter what the symptom package is that walks into your office. What's really walking into your office is a story. And you have that person who's telling a story about their life and the story that they believe other people are telling about them. And the way that they're telling their story, to the degree that it is misaligned with ultimately what the gospel's story is going to be a feature of the symptoms that they have. Our symptoms that we have are expressions of my mind trying to be shoehorned into a story it was never meant to live. Are you with me? Here's some things about storytelling in human beings. The first thing is that your story was told before you were ever born. Right? Your parents, like I said, your parents, everybody here has been born. I don't think there's any AI-generated beings in the room yet. Okay? You were born, and before you were born, your parents were telling a story about you. And some of us have stories in which our parents were really thrilled. Others have stories in which the parents maybe were anxious, like mine. Others come from stories in which you don't even know your parents. So your story was told about you before you were born, and then you get here, and your story is still told about you primarily by somebody else, because you come into the world and they put you in a onesie. I can tell you, I'm guessing nobody here is dressed in a onesie. Oh, maybe there is. I don't. But you know what I mean, right? They're going to put you in clothes that you didn't choose. They're going to take you to play dates when you're two, because, you know, it's their best friend who also has a child, and you hate this kid, and you don't know why you're going to have a play date with this person, but your story is being told. Oh, honey, you know, no, you need to let me share the toy with him. I don't want to share the freaking toy with him. Are you with me? Your story is being told by somebody else, and that leads to the reality that we become increasingly aware that our stories are always eventually told collaboratively. Because at some point, somebody taught you the word please. Somebody taught you the word thank you. Somebody taught you your colors. Somebody taught you how to do your multiplication tables. Your story about the world and about yourself is being interpreted by your parents, by the people that you're having your primary attachment experiences with. Your story is always being told collaboratively, back into who are the people with whom you are collaborating and are telling your story on a regular basis. What is your experience of being known by them? Here's something else. Most of our stories are told largely without language. We have all kinds of thoughts that are banging around in our head, but I can assure you that what is most powerfully shaping your thoughts, what is most powerfully shaping the sense of all that, are all of the sensations, images, and feelings that precede your language. Imagine going into a movie theater and the lights go down, and then all you get is dialogue. You don't even see the screen. No, because so much of what brings you to the movies is not just the dialogue, it's everything else that is about the story. And then the other thing that we realize is that our stories, we don't just have them because we have them. We have them because we were made to tell them because we want them to be heard. I want someone else to hear my story. Most normally developed children, by the time they find one word, and then two words, and then three words, and then you can't shut them up. Right? Why? Right? There's all these words that start to come. And I know that different people eventually, by the time they become adults, we have different tolerance for a certain amount of words. My wife and our daughter, when our daughter was in high school and a Girl Scout, they went to Belize. She and their troop went to Belize for a service project. Belize, service project, yeah, come on. Right, because they're gone for like 5 days. At least my son and me, who's like in age, I think he's in like 8th grade, 7th grade, alone in the house. The relief of having so few words having to be spoken. And we then go pick them up at the airport when they get home. They get in the van. My wife and daughter get in the van. They start to talk. My son is sitting behind me, like on the passenger side of the back. I look in the rearview mirror. His eyes are as big as saucers, right? Because, like, there's so many words. We have stories that long to be told because we want to tell them, because we want to be heard. We don't have them just capriciously. We don't have them just to be having words banging around our head. We have stories that long to be. Who is hearing you tell your story? And the last thing to say before we take a break. Therapists know this, but often therapists are not nearly as aware of the profundity of the role that you play, and that stories are told profoundly by those who are listening to them. We've all had experiences of people who've listened well and people who haven't. And when the people have listened well, our story is a very different one. The people are not listening well. Are you with me? And so it's important for us to recognize that, who are the people who are listening well to us? And are we spending too much time than we need to be talking to people who aren't? All these things get us to a point. These are the mechanics of the mind. They're important for us. We haven't even gotten yet formally to the Bible. But when we come back from our break, we're going to have a sense of this that we just talked about is what evil, this is what evil targets with its use of shame. And we're going to see how that happens. So we're going to come back in about 15 minutes, and we'll get started. Right? So I'm going to start at about 10.